Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and has just bought two genuine tear-stained tissues from Lionel Messi on eBay. I'm Kevin Day, the laughing boy in the background is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, I hope they're genuine tissues. I'm getting a bit worried that at Lionel Messi, PSG, Spain may be a chance. He's only got 96 followers. What an emotional farewell the billionaire Lionel Messi paid to the club that made him a billionaire as he went to the club that will make him another billionaire. And how odd that he's always wanted to play for PSG. Anyway, now, Kieran, we were so intrigued about a recent mention of Channel Islands football on the pod that we arranged to speak to Ian Horswell, who's chief executive of Combined Counties Football League side Jersey Bulls. They're in the ninth level of the English Pyramid, the first Jersey club to be in the English Pyramid. And we had a very, very interesting and somewhat eye-opening chat with Ian, which is coming up. But before that interview, we have some news. And Kieran, you've been indulging in your favourite pastime. You've been number-crunching the Premier League's finances.
Yes, I have, because now that we have a full complement of accounts, it's that time of the year where I start designing the next set of Price of Football top trumps cards. those went down well last year. Nobody really wants any of last year's.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have to say, they're very comfortable. I'm sitting on a pile of them as we speak. So, yeah.
just to sort of see the first impact of COVID as far as the Premier League as a whole was concerned. And it's, you know, even though COVID only started in March and therefore it impacted upon the last few games of the season, it was still quite substantial. Overall, £633 million less was generated in 2019-20 compared to the previous season. And that's the first time the Premier League's had a reduction in revenue effectively in its history. So it was tough for the clubs. And I know that people were saying, should the Premier League be giving more support to other parts of football? And I think it's our belief that they should do.
Yeah.
But they struggled themselves. If you took a look at the total losses that the Premier League clubs, it was only Sheffield United that made any noticeable profit. Overall, the losses exceeded £1 billion. Now, they managed to get some of those losses down through player sales, but even so, it was we've spoken about our clubs and the fact that Brighton lost close to £70 million. Palace lost plenty as well. Mm. And we just blinked. We didn't even get upset by it because by that stage we'd become so familiar with clubs announcing eye-watering losses that we thought, oh, that's actually not too bad. And it's a very, very strange set of circumstances that we find ourselves in. And I still think it's amazing that, with the exception of Macclesfield Town, whose demise wasn't to do with COVID, that we've managed to get through from then to now with no casualties.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why people are sanguine about the losses, because there was a time right at the start of COVID when we predicted that possibly 30 or 40 clubs could go to the wall because their finances were already precarious. I think when you say to a Palace fan or a Brighton fan, we've only lost 50 million quid, it's because there was a chance that we could have lost the club, even Premier League clubs. So I think that's sort of why people are not dropping their jaws at these figures. The Sheffield United one is really interesting. Why were they the only club to make a profit? Is that because they were financially very well run, or was it the massive feel-good factor of promotion to the Premier League just increasing their revenues hugely?
Well, it was their first season in the Premier League. Yeah. And if you think about it, Chris Wilder kept faith with a large number of the squad that had brought them into the top tier. So whilst those players would have had step-ups in terms of their contracts, they weren't having to bring in players who are on the, you know, 40 to 50 grand a week, which is the norm in the Premier League. And also, Sheffield United had a fantastic first season. So they benefited from finishing in the top half of the Premier League. And remember, you get an extra £2 million per place. So, you know, if we're honest, I think a lot of people thought, you know, will they be a one season wonder? And they'll go down. If they break even, then fine. But, you know, I think they finished ninth in that first season. So that was worth, you know, an extra over £20 million. And because they were playing good football as well, they appeared on a few more occasions on TV, and you get bonuses for that. So it was pretty good. And of course, you know, the following season, I suspect they will have made substantial losses because they went out into the transfer market, and, you know, their cost went up, and the revenues will have been hit because no match day for the full season and a lot less TV money on the back of being relegated.
Do you think, Kieran, that Premier League clubs and others will be using COVID as an excuse? They'll be brushing financial misdemeanours under the COVID carpet for some years to come?
Yeah, it's a convenient excuse. Although, in my view, that they needed to have been cutting back before COVID anyway, because the Premier League was getting a little bit frothy. In terms of costs were continuing to go up, wages and transfer spends were continually rising. And to a certain extent, I think we've reached peak Premier League. You know, we saw the value of the domestic TV deal fall in the deal that we're presently in. And there's little opportunity for significant growth going forwards, because it takes time to make the stadiums bigger or move to a new stadium. So, you know, if you want to increase your match day, the commercial partners, they've now reached a position where, you know, in a post-COVID environment, are they really getting value for money splashing the names of their products across shirts? And TV, you know, they're not bringing in new subscribers to TV, and it's a case of, well, we have to be careful about not losing our existing ones, and we can't therefore necessarily afford to increase the price of subscriptions. You know, I always get I'm not advertising here. I always get the Now TV season ticket for sport, and that's £200 a year. If they increase the price of that, I'd probably turn it down. So I think everybody connected with the sport is now realizing, how are we going to generate additional money? At the same time, costs are going up because you don't want to lose your star players, or you do want to recruit good ones.
Yeah, you enjoy your annual game of brinkmanship with Now TV, don't you?
Well, yes. I mean, and you know, if you wait and wait, they will always come up with a good offer. And I think, you know, people have got to be prepared to try to negotiate good deals. You know, whilst I do that as far as, you know, football and TV is concerned, I should be doing it on other aspects of life. But, you know, I just, you know, like most people, got better things to do with my time.
Yeah, well, see, unfortunately, one of the very many financial idiocies I have is that Ali will say, no, these people, they'll give you a better deal if you wait. Yeah. And I just tick the top box. I just go, oh, that looks good. You get everything on that one. She says, you don't like horror films. Why are you going for the horror channel as well? Just, no, it's just easier. Just have everything. Now, I've asked producer Guy to add a fanfare after this, or possibly a heavenly choir, or possibly a Swanee whistle. I don't know. But Newcastle United have filed their accounts for 2019-20. Hallelujah.
Yes. Mike Ashley is like that child at school who's always late with his homework, and it's frustrating because you know, if they'd submitted them a few weeks earlier, it wouldn't have made a blind bit of difference. It would have simply allowed me to get my spreadsheet more up to date, which I enjoy doing. But for a man who has been criticising the Premier League for a lack of transparency,
yeah,
you know, why is it that Newcastle United are normally 20th out of 20 in terms of clubs that publish their accounts, or 19th. You know, so this is part of the mystery, I think, of Mike Ashley. He's a very, very smart bloke. You know, I know people that have done business with him, and they say, you know, his ability to crunch the numbers in his head is absolutely amazing, second to none in many regards. But his sort of love-hate relationship with transparency is a frustrating one. So in terms of Newcastle, they did lose money, but here we go. They only lost £500,000 a week. And we think, oh, that's actually really good. And that's part of the position that we find ourselves in. There were some unusual nuggets in that the chief executive's pay that nearly trebled. It went from 267 to 675 grand for the year. Crikey. Although by Premier League standards, that's actually quite low.
Is it? 675 a year. That's low.
That's low. Yeah. The business side of football, if I'm honest, doesn't actually pay particularly well. If you're working in sort of, you know, many of the backroom areas of the game, but chief executives, some of them are on extremely good wages. There's quite a few on 2 million plus these days. They'll argue with some justification that it's a multi-million pound industry and they should be paid accordingly. That headhunting does take place. So, you know, sometimes you have to pay somebody a lot of money to prevent him from going to another club.
But in general, though, apart from that, not as eye-watering as I thought it was amount of money for the chief exec, Newcastle's accounts were no better or no worse than most clubs in the Premier League and what you'd expect after the time we've been having.
Yes. They're solid enough. Pay did go up. You know, the wage bill went up quite considerably, but... an extra £20 million on the wage bill, but you've got some players renewing their contracts. You've got a few players coming in. The one thing which really hit me, and I think this is indicative, this is textbook Mike Ashley. If you're about to sell your house, the last thing you do is stick in a new bathroom or kitchen or whatever. And if you take a look at the amount of money that was spent on the facility, so we're talking the training facilities, the office, the offices that they occupy, and the ground itself. He spent 200 grand, which was a tenth of the amount of the club that was 19th in the table of infrastructure spend. Wow. And of course, you've got some clubs spending millions upon millions. And over the past 3 years, he spent just over a million. So clearly, Mike Ashley, what he's trying to do is. You know, it's a bit like when not that I would ever do this, of course. I look at the tyres on the car and say, can I get another? Can I get another 5,000 miles out of them before I, nip down to Quick Fit or wherever it's going to be? You do that when you think, it would be probably more sensible to get new tyres now. Just it's better to be safe than sorry. So it's very clear that the spend on the club I know Newcastle fans have commented it's starting to look a bit shabby, and we've also we've also commented ourselves about Old Trafford. Yes, it's the Theatre of Dreams, yes, it's iconic, you go inside, it's shabby. And under Mike Ashley, the money that's being spent on the ground is the bare minimum. And it means that whoever inherits the club is going to have to go and spend that money themselves.
Yeah, no, a lot of Newcastle fans would have had a spring in their step for about 3 seconds this week when they saw the headline, Mike Ashley resigns. But he's resigned from his own company, Sports Direct. Will that have any effect? I mean, it's an odd thing to think about, resigning from your own company in the first place. But will that have any impact on his role at Newcastle United?
I don't think so, because he effectively delegates everything at Newcastle United to Lee Charnley, who's the chief exec. So, right, okay. Yes, he will be consulted if money needs to be spent, But yet he's still owed. He's still owed, I think it's £107 million now by the club. It was 152 as recently as 2017. So, you know, where there's an opportunity to slightly nudge down the amount of money that's owed to him, that is taken. At the same time, you know, that money is lent interest-free, whereas if we compare that to David Golden, David Sullivan at West Ham, you know, they're charging interest on it. So, you know, he's not extracting money from the club in that way. Although his critics will say, such is the very close link between Newcastle and Sports Direct, that the club is getting, remember, he tried to rename St James's Park, didn't he, the Sports Direct Arena, and that was, even by his standards of having a tin ear, that was spectacularly bad, and that got reversed very quickly. You know, Sports Direct does benefit from its association with Newcastle United, although I think that relationship is going to continue to diminish, and certainly as soon as Mike Ashley goes, I would imagine the new owners would want to terminate that immediately.
This is an interesting one, slightly odd as well. An investigation by Al Jazeera has found that offshore trusts can disguise people with criminal convictions who want to invest in football. And I presume we're not talking fake mustaches here, are we?
No. This is a documentary which has been put out by the Al Jazeera I unit, their investigations unit. And you know, I'm going to hold my hands up here. I've been involved with this in the sense that they brought me in to comment about 6 months ago. In terms of the footage that has been taken and the comments that have come in. Now, I'm going to choose my words very carefully because in order to get the show out, it clearly had to go through the lawyers. And I've also seen probably about three times as much as went out because, you know, the lawyers would say, yeah, but they get out their big black felt tip pens and say, no, you can't say that. You can't. But this really focused around a for want of a better word, a broker, a guy called Chris Samuelson, who has been connected with clubs. You know, he has been on the board of a couple of football clubs, and he is known within the industry. At one stage, he was trying to get some involvement in terms of the sale of our favourite club, Derby County, but there's been nothing untoward from the Derby County side. In respect of Chris Samuelson, it was the equivalent of a fake shake undercover sting, in the sense that there were two reporters who claimed to be operating on behalf of Mr. X, and you can't, you know, you can't have a proper documentary unless you've got a really good Mr. X.
Absolutely.
And Mr. X had been sentenced in absentia in Asia for money laundering and bribery activities by a government. And he wanted to acquire a football club, and for, you know, the purposes behind he wanting to buy those football clubs, they were sort of, you know, they were hinted at, shall we say. You know, the footage of Chris Samuelson indicated that he did not see this as being a problem. Right. And it was he was also had a person that he works with who is a former detective in the Met who runs a private detective agency or an investigations agency. And, there were things such as, well, you know, if there's a problem with the identity of the person, we can arrange offshore trusts, but we can also get involved with potentially the Cypriot government. Now, there's been some really big issues, and I've taught in Cyprus for around about 15 years, and I've not been there since COVID, of course, Cyprus has a fairly, and you can't defame a country, so I can say this. Cyprus has a fairly relaxed approach to issuing passports if you have the right connections.
Yeah, Malta as well. It's a similar attitude. It's very easy to get a Maltese identity as well.
Yes. Yeah. And therefore, yeah, Mr. X could potentially take on the identity of somebody from Cyprus, and the people involved seem to think that therefore passing the owners and directors test would not be an issue.
Right.
So it's intriguing stuff. It does show the length that some people are willing to go to circumvent the rules which are there to protect the game. And also, I do think it shows that the Premier League and the EFL have a really challenging job, because you've got to operate in, to a certain extent, in good faith. And whilst there are people around whose approach is to see rules as a challenge rather than something to be complied with, it's going to make their job more difficult. So, I would recommend people have a look on it. They can see it on YouTube. It's called the Men Who Buy Football Clubs. I'm not being paid by Al Jazeera to advertise it, but I was asked, and other people have been asked. I think it's a guy from Transparency International.
Mm.
It's murky stuff, and we know murky in football, don't we?
We do, yeah. We're still negotiating with the EFL to get a senior executive from there to come and chat to us. They're very willing to do so as a body, but individually, they seem to be finding it difficult to get someone to volunteer. But that will be a question we certainly will put to them if we do get to speak to them. Real Madrid have kicked off their legal fights against the big La Liga investment deal we discussed last week, which sounds like good news for nuestros amigos de lengua plateada. Or if the lawyers are women, nuestras amigas de lengua plateada. Anyway, so that hasn't taken long, has it? As you predicted last week, we talked about this huge investment deal, and it hasn't taken long for Real Madrid to kick back.
Yes, and I'm not hugely surprised by that. La Liga negotiated. I think there were about 12 clubs that were involved with this deal with CVC. It's worth 2.7 billion euro, and it looks as if the bigger clubs, the likes of Barcelona and Real Madrid, they would have had a significant slice of this. Around about 250 million euro each, which would have dug them out of a hole. Although, my understanding from looking at the small print, that relatively little of that would have flowed through into the financial fair play variant that they use in Spain. But certainly from a cash flow point of view, it would have been beneficial. As we feared, the relationships between Tebas and Perez, Tebas who is head of La Liga and Perez who's head of Real Madrid, that relationship is not good, because La Liga were opposed to Super League, and Florentino Perez still claims it's going to save football by giving more money to his club. and that's the bit. I try to be as objective as I can, because I deal with numbers. And I say, well, giving one person a lot of money, how does that benefit everybody else in society? And this is what's called trickle-down economics.
And
to date, there is no evidence to back up that it works. I'm not, but it doesn't mean that at some point in the future, giving Real Madrid a lot more money won't benefit Exeter Town. But we've not that link at present seems to be a bit tenuous. So, Real Madrid are taking legal action. They say they weren't involved in the discussions, and they also believe that the deal undervalues La Liga. And I did see one report that actually it's 10% of the broadcast and commercial income for 50 years. And under those circumstances, well, yeah, let's face it, you and I aren't going to be hosting this pod in 50 years, or if we are, we will be cryogenically preserved when we do it. Which will be interesting, but we'll I can see that is that number is that number too low? But Italian football turned down an offer of around about half the amount. The Bundesliga, they had discussions with private equity and they turned it down as well. Is it that this is a much better deal, or is it that Spanish football is more desperate? Private equity companies don't have a reputation for being, fun-loving guys in terms of looking after people. So, caution, I would certainly promote there.
Yeah. Yes, Exeter City fans. Kieran did say Exeter Town.
Sorry.
That's fine. Kieran's a very busy man. He's got a lot of thoughts in his head. He doesn't drink, so he gets confused occasionally. don't tweet. We do know. And a final news story, Kieran, before our interview with Ian from the Jersey Bulls. Borussia Dortmund made a big loss in 2021.
Yeah, I think this is interesting in that they are the first football club to publish a full set of accounts for 2020-21, and that is remarkably quick.
Yeah,
given that there's at least one club I can think of in the East Midlands that hasn't published anything since 2018.
Are German clubs prone to publish their accounts earlier? Are the rules in Germany any different?
I think there's a bit more pressure on them. I don't want to go down the route of, German efficiency. Well, what do we expect here? Because that's just lazy of me, but I've said it anyway. I think it was intriguing that Dortmund did make, I think it was around about 70 million euro of losses. But what have they done since those accounts have come out? That they've sold Jadon Sancho, and that's effectively, taken a huge chunk off those losses. But the impact of COVID is significant. They make around about 600,000 euro a match from catering, which is phenomenal. But then you think, well, hold on, I've been to Germany to watch football, and boy, can they drink, and they know how to knock it back. So perhaps that isn't an unrealistic sum, but it does show that the club is very efficient at making match day as lucrative as possible. You take away match day, and clearly the club's going to be hit.
Yeah, I'm happy to say, Kieran, that the German games I've been to, even the drinking has been done efficiently. I admire the way, especially Union Berlin, is an incredible operation. The way they got 12 pints inside them before, during, and after the game, and tied it up after themselves, and gave the bottles to homeless charities because you still get deposits on bottles there.
Brilliant.
It's very, very good.
Now, I love German fan culture. Absolutely love it.
Do you know what? It's really interesting when you talk to German fans, because they always say it's a homage, if you like, to English fan culture from the 70s and 80s that they grew up with. But my God, I wish football had been half as much fun in the 70s and 80s as they seem to, as they seem to think it was, because they've distilled all the good bits and got rid of the bad bits. Anybody who ever gets a chance and is able to financially should try and get to a German football game at one stage in their life. Even simple things like the ticket for the game, including public transport to the game as well. It's a brilliant fan culture. Now, Kieran, we had a question, as you remember, on our last pod about Jersey Bulls, who currently reside in the ninth tier of the English football pyramid. And it led to a surprising amount of discussion on social media about football in the Channel Islands. So for answers, we went straight to the horse's mouth, the bull's mouth, and we spoke to Chief Executive Ian Horswell, and I started with a very important historical question. Ian, thank you so much for joining us. It's lovely to talk to you. But first of all, can I just check something? Has anyone in your family ever been a sheriff on the island and had a run-in with a chippy South Londoner?
The answer, and good morning, guys, the answer to that is no. I'm not sure what badge he was wearing saying he's a sheriff, We have honorary police over here in Jersey, which sounded like they're the kind of guys that would be checking your bushes, so to speak. So I think it was one of those guys that you probably had the run-in with.
Well, welcome to the pod with a checking the bush joke straight away in. Thank you. I'm even more worried now that I might have been taken in by a bloke claiming to be a sheriff, not even a real sheriff. That's terrible.
It's highly possible.
Ian, we talked to you in a week of football history. Last Saturday, the FA Cup came to the island for the first time ever, and you became the first club in 75 years to score 10 goals on their cup debut. Talk us through the day. That sounds amazing.
Yes, it really was amazing, Kevin. But for more ways than one, we hadn't played at home in Jersey for over 500 days. The last fixture was the 7th of March, 2020, on the day that we sort of sealed mathematically promotion to the next league. Mm. But we'll touch on that one later.
And yeah,
so for all the fans to come back, it was just an incredible moment to have fans back after, you know, that such a long absence. Mm. COVID has obviously been problematic globally. Jersey's been no different. Our government are obviously separate to the UK government, and we make decisions on Ireland that are obviously different. We let things run a little bit, and during the course of the early summer here, we actually had the highest number of COVID cases in the British Isles.
Good Lord, really?
Yeah, so that obviously had lots of ramifications. Again, a pre-season tournament we had was going to occur, which again, that's another topic to talk about later. So we were actually under crowd restrictions, and we limited the capacity of the stadium to 50%. And we sold out. We had to make it all ticket for the first time for COVID to prevent queuing. We didn't open our club shop to prevent queuing. We had to rent various parts of the stadium because the stadium isn't owned by the football club. It's a government facility. So we put a supporters lunch on in the sports hall. We had a hospitality lunch in another room. And obviously there's a cafe and bar there, which that's a separate concession run by a private company. They were limited to have people in. So it was a real difficult day. But logistically, we had plenty of stewards and a lot of support from our volunteers. And to get 975 people through the door, to have our sort of ultras, if you like, banging the drums, beeping the horns and all of that. It was just an amazing occasion, not just for the football club, but for the island of Jersey and the local football community.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
It's strange, isn't it? It seems counterintuitive. You'd think an island would be able to control COVID better than that, wouldn't you, really? But that's for a different podcast. And it's brilliant that it happened. And so if you had 975 people, you basically scored one goal for almost every 100 people in there. So it was 10-1 in the end, wasn't it?
It was 10-1. And I really felt for the opposition. It was like everything that could go wrong for them did go wrong for them. They lost three players in the first half to injury.
Oh, crikey, right.
And then in the second half, it was 4-1 with 72 minutes gone, and their keeper accidentally handled it outside the area. There was no striker near him, and letter of the law means it should be a red card. So we scored the resulting free kick against an outfield goalkeeper, and we ended up scoring another five in the last sort of 18 minutes on top of that to compound it. So I did really feel for Horsham YMCA, and it was one of those days when everything went right for the Jersey Bulls.
Yeah, but well, I suppose they had the consolation of being on a beautiful island for a couple of hours anyway. But in the next round, you're away to New Haven, but you've decided between you that there will be no replay. Why is that?
So basically, if there was a draw after 90 minutes, the replay, because of the close proximity of matches in the FA Cup in the qualifiers, they're literally played every fortnight. We would have to have a replay on the island either Tuesday, Wednesday or Thursday of the following week. So there's no time really to get a replay in. Now, The problem we've got with Jersey, as I mentioned about COVID earlier, Kevin, is if these guys were to fly over on a Tuesday night, they would have to actually stay over in a hotel. And if they're double vaccinated, our rules are if you're double vaccinated, you can come into the island, but we will give you a PCR test on landing. Right. And you'll get your results anything between, I don't know, 6 to 12 hours. Now, if you were to test positive, and we all know you can test positive even if you are double jabbed and you might not have any symptoms, if you do test positive, you won't be going on the plane home. You'll be in Jersey. I'm not going to say it's a sunny island. I know you don't like the sun. It's a beautiful island.
Yes.
And you'd be here for 10 days. And I don't know if your partner or your work would have something to say about that. So that was the same with Horsham on Saturday, that the guys were desperate to enjoy the island life and have a night out in St Helier, which is a great night out. But because of COVID restrictions, nightclubs aren't open here yet. It's coming soon. And also, I explained that rule about having to be here for 10 days. So we said we can only really play on Saturdays, get the teams in and out in a day to run the risk of not having anyone having to isolate on our beautiful island.
This is a really interesting insight, Ian, because we all know we've been talking about COVID restrictions for a year, but this is the first time we've actually spoken to somebody who runs a club about the actual details of how difficult it's making life. And I suppose as well, the question everybody tweeted to ask us when we spoke about Jersey Bulls on the last pod was about the cost of away travel. So Newhaven not flying over for an away game will save you about £4,000 a game, I believe. Is that how much it costs you to travel, cover travel costs for the away team? Was that part of the deal of allowing you to become the first Jersey club to join the English pyramid? Was that part of the deal that you covered the transport costs for every home game?
Yes, it's the same for all the island clubs. We've got Guernsey FC who play in the Isthmian League, and we've got FC Isle of Man who play up in the Northwest County. So that's the rules that we have to abide by at the moment to pay all the visiting expenses and referees to come into our islands to participate in the league, the National League system. We do hope one day that that will fall away, because naturally, you know, probably the highest national league that we can get to is the lowest national league we can get to is the Step One National League. If we look at last season, Hartlepool would have travelled to Torquay and vice versa.
Yeah.
Now that's a longer trip than Jersey to Gatwick. So for that reason, you know, Hartlepool don't pay Torquay's expenses and vice versa. So we're hoping if, you know, any of the island clubs do get to that level, then that may fall away in the future. But that's a conversation for a few years' time. But certainly we do pay the travel expenses. We have an arrangement whereby if you can fly in and out in the day, then that's acceptable. But naturally, in the winter months in Jersey, we don't have as many flights coming in and out. So therefore, it's you have to stay overnight in the island. So therefore, we'd pay for the hotel accommodation. So it all depends on your fixtures, on whether you're, you know, early in the season when there's lots of flights and you can get in and out the day or whether you cannot.
So if you're spending around £4,000 a game to bring the away team to your matches, is that leaving you with any profit after match day expenses, etc.?
Very, very little for home games. So if I can put it another way, I was speaking to a chairman of an EFL club, and he was saying his expenses could be anything between sort of 40 and 50K for a season, as a three times that. And we're obviously playing in Division 9 of the English football pyramid, if you like. So FA competitions, whilst Kieran mentioned the prize money on the last pod, that is obviously gratefully received. But it only goes a small way to helping us sort of balance the books. So what happens in FA competitions, we have to pay for the visiting side to come over, the officials to come over. We hire our stadium. Again, we've subsequently rented additional rooms within the facilities to help our fans have an enjoyable match day experience whilst not taking any of the secondary revenue on a bar, which is obviously, a real killer at our level.
Yeah, of course.
The great thing is the FA actually changed the rules for offshore clubs this year. So we're actually now able to claim back 75% of the travel costs. And then we have to share the gates after that. So we'll be paying Horsham YMCA an amount of money. But in previous years, it would have been a lot more punchy, and we would have made a significant loss of entering an FA competition such as the VARs or the FA Cup. So we're delighted they've changed that. Hopefully that will be enough to spur Guernsey on to come back into the competitions next year, because financially it's just not worth it for offshore clubs.
As we said, you're the first Jersey club to be allowed to join the English pyramid. Was the French pyramid ever an option? Because, I mean, travel-wise, that would seem to make more sense, wouldn't it?
Logistically, yes. We're 14 miles from France, and you can visually see France from our north and west coast, sorry, east coast. But I think someone's looked at it in the past. It was never something that sort of excited me in terms of, you know, being a sort of football romantic and, you know, the pyramid in England. You know, you've just got so many different ceilings, and, you know, we're never going to get to the ceiling, the top of the ceiling. We're realistic. But, you know, the opportunities to play in some of those competitions I just mentioned, the FA Vars, the FA Cup, you know, can you go through a couple of rounds and create history or amazing memories, which football does for people by getting a great tie. So that's the romance of the cup. And, you know, the English route was the only one in sort of my eyes. I do think people have possibly looked at France in the past. I know the local rugby club, who are fully professional. Admittedly, there's no Jerseyman playing in that team, and we are all full of Jersey born and schooled lads, have looked at the French option because I think their franchise system's quite attractive. But, you know, we're fully committed to England and you know, thoroughly enjoying the ride. And it's been a great ride, apart from this virus that's come along and took the stuffing out of everybody.
But Kieran, as we've talked about the pyramid a lot, there will be money to be made for the Jersey Bulls, because as they rise through the leagues, as they inevitably will, because they're a good side, they're going to become the must go to away game, aren't they, for just about every club, essentially. So they're going to be getting 1,000 people, away fans, on the island when all this is over. And that's going to be a substantial boost to revenue, isn't it?
I think there's certainly potential there. You know, as a ground hopper myself, you know, it would be a great weekend. And also it's for some clubs, they'll think this is the nearest we're ever going to get to playing overseas. So, you know, that'll attract fans as well. Having said that, you know, as Ian's intimated, it's an expensive business running a club. So anything which can bring in additional revenues has got to be applauded.
It's a bone of contention, Ian, that Kieran's been to more grounds than I have, but it's only because Brighton have been in more leagues than Palace have, to be perfectly honest. If they'd managed to stay in the top two divisions for the most of their career, they'd be far fewer grounds. Tell us about football on the island in general, Ian. How many other clubs are there? You're attracting that huge number, 976, which is only half. So you're getting 1,500 people in, which is a good crowd. How does it work? I was going to ask you about the players. You're obviously amateur and all the players are local, which is a good thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got a really good football ecosystem on the island, Kevin. We must have now around about 20 clubs. I'm estimating.
20?
Yes.
Wow. And what's the population of the island?
It's about 105,000, 107,000.
So that's a lot of clubs wow, that's brilliant.
Sport's a massive part of island life, and you know, we're very blessed with you know, lots of quality on the island, from sort of coaches through to players, and a lot of our players in a variety of sports have gone on to you know, do great things professionally at a variety of sports. Obviously, Graham Lasso would be the most famous footballer that we can mention. Yeah. Serena Guthrie in netball, and we've got, you know, lads that have gone on to do pro cricket and rugby and so on and so forth. So we're very lucky, and we do generate players. And again, just sort of hopping around, that's another area where, you know, in the past on the pod you've talked about academies and how players you know, get signed from other clubs and the smaller club gets remunerated. We don't have that opportunity at the moment because we don't have an academy per se. So there are other things in the future that hopefully the Bulls can benefit, because we've got four lads currently with EFL clubs in academies in the UK, which has meant the families have had to move to the mainland for them to hopefully make their careers. But going back to the local clubs, as I say, the ecosystem here is fantastic. Around about 20 clubs. When we presented our case study of creating the football club to the local football association, I think there's been an increase of maybe 20% of new clubs since that day, because there was some argument, oh, wouldn't we damage the local football scene? Yeah. In terms of quality, yes, we probably have a little bit, because as you can imagine, the best players want to further their opportunities and play within the pyramid. So some of the top players are obviously now playing for us, and there's some very good players that don't, because, you know, it could be family or work commitments, so they can't commit to the travel. So the league is still good. It's becoming and it will be very competitive this season, which is great for the neutral. And all of these clubs, I'd say about 70% of them have their own grounds. And again, they've got multiple teams. One side over here have got in excess of 20 teams, which is amazing. So we do everything from walking football to you know, under sixes. So it's a very good footballing scene. And you know, this is where the Bulls are very fortunate that we can tap into the local clubs. If they've got players that are developing, you know, we can bring promising youngsters through into our system and help get them spotted.
Oh, and also, you talking about walking football, football for youngsters, it's yet another example of a club at the heart of its community doing good for the community. It's not just bringing football to the area, it's bringing fitness, it's bringing mental well-being, it's bringing sociability. So any football club can only be an asset to its area, I always proclaim.
I totally agree. Now, we obviously formed a company back in 2018 and the club was launched in 2019. And all we've managed to do so far, and I say all, I'm quite harsh on myself and ourselves, is launch a football club that costs around about £300,000 a year to run, and no one gets paid. We're all volunteers. So that was it's a huge undertaking to do that. As I mentioned before, we've got a lot of revenue streams that aren't open to us right now. You know, we want to change that in the future. So currently the way we survive financially is via sponsorships, fundraising, our gate receipts and merchandise sales. So that's the only ones that we've got open to us at the moment, but there's lots of other ways which we want to through time. Now, COVID, as I say, it's affected everybody. And if COVID didn't come along, then I genuinely would have felt we probably would have employed an administrator at this by now. And the administrator could have locked, you know, taking the burden away from the board and the executive committee that run the club on a day-to-day basis, and helped us grow in other areas. So again, we're very keen. You mentioned community at the moment. We do have a community program. We have a schools program, which is great, whereby a local primary school will come for free to the game. They're the match day mascots. They play on the pitch at halftime. And, you know, we go in and do assemblies. We talk about, you know, well-being. We talk about sport. We talk about football. We talk about the Bulls and then invite the kids along. And that's been extremely popular. But obviously, sadly, the kids haven't been. And because of COVID, we didn't do the kids on Saturday. But hopefully our next home game, unless we get an FA Cup tie, is the 18th of September, whereby we won't have any restrictions, hopefully, in Jersey, and the children will come back as matchday mascots, which is great. So the community is a huge part of our growth plans, and that is something that we really want to do and embrace that. So for an example, last week, Southampton Football Club were over doing a weekly holiday school. But that's something, you know, that's our patch. We would love to do that in the future. And, yeah, you know, course. Not to say to a Premier League club, sorry, you can't come, but we can certainly offer that on our own patch in the future. So there's lots of promising ideas that the club have got in the future. And as I say, once we can get some more certainty into our lives, then we'll be able to kick on and really grow the club.
Kieran, it's amazing to think, both with your accountant's hat on and with your football fan hat on, that Jersey Bulls doing all this for the community, for football, and not one single person on or off the pitch is actually being paid for it. They're all volunteers. That's a remarkable effort, isn't it?
It's sensational. And I think it does restore faith. I've spent most of the last week in TV and radio studios talking about £100 million transfers and crazy money being spent on Lionel Messi's wages. And this is so much more grounded. And this is actually why we fell in love with football, because we all started off with park football and things like that. And it's inspiring.
Yeah, that airplane noise you can hear in the background is Guy flying over just to check that we're doing things properly. Ian, UEFA and FIFA rejected the Jersey FA's application to join. For reasons we've yet to fully ascertain. Is that an ambition that you would hope to revive in the future?
Personally, I'd like to see that happen. That would be the conversation with the Jersey Football Association. So we're obviously we're an affiliated club to the association. Now, I remember being back at school, and I think Kieran mentioned a tournament that the Islands play in called the Island Games.
That was my next question, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember back in the 90s, we played the Faroe Islands in one of the games, and we lost 4-3. So as you can see there, you know, we were on the same sort of, you know, ability trajectory. But after that tournament, that was their last tournament, and they went on to join UEFA and subsequently FIFA. You know, couple of years in, they beat Austria. And, you know, a lot of people, myself included, thought that could have been us. Mm. Now, Gibraltar were the last ones to sort of make it in from the sort of offshore island, so to speak. But again, they did it before UEFA closed the loophole. I'm a pub lawyer like you, so I don't know the terminology here, but we took it to as far as we could, and we went to we managed to get a vote. And again, going back to what Kieran mentioned so much is self-interest. And if you imagine you're 50 odd members of UEFA and you're sharing a pie of X and you have to share it one more person, you're going to say no. And that's exactly what the UEFA members did. Now, you're absolutely right. I think you mentioned on the pod on Monday that we are bigger than Faroes, Liechtenstein, Andorra, San Marino, and we absolutely are. And you know, we've kind of pretty much beaten San Marino before. So as I say, personally, I'd love to see the island of Jersey continue and do that. And I think it would complement Jersey Bulls Football Club, and I also think it'd be great for the island. And you know, there's a lot more money in UEFA, and that would boost the local games as the local league as well by pumping in revenue into there. Does Jersey Bulls FC see that? We wouldn't see it directly, but indirectly, we'd hope to benefit. You know, that whether that's be better facilities in the island. And I think just for the listeners, just to explain how effectively that would work. If you imagine Wales, for example, the Welsh national side, that would effectively be the Jersey national side. Swansea and Cardiff would effectively be Jersey Bulls Football Club playing in England, but are from Wales / Jersey. And then the local clubs in Wales will be playing in the Welsh Premier League, and we would have our Jersey Premier League. And that's how it would work. If you were the champions of Wales or champions of Jersey, you would go into those Champions League qualifiers. It wouldn't affect Jersey Bulls. We would not be in Europe, so to speak.
I went to see Liechtenstein play Latvia in the Euro qualifier. Long story, you don't need to know the circumstances. But if Liechtenstein, I mean, they literally, it was like watching a Sunday football game, and you kind of think, if Liechtenstein, and it's a lovely place, but if they're in UEFA, there's no earthly reason why Jersey shouldn't be. Having said that, everything I've seen and read about the Ireland games make them sound like a lot of fun to take part in. They were due to be in Guernsey, weren't they? But again, COVID has stepped in.
Yes, that's right. A lot of our players have participated in Ireland games, and it's literally a week of sport. Basically, you know, they are a lot of fun. But what you do have to do is play an awful lot of football in a short period of time. So you could have five consecutive days of matches. So you know, it's important that you've got a big and quality squad to be able to do that. But I've not been to an Ireland games, but a lot of my a lot of my friends have, and you know, they're great occasions.
You're a very new club, and you won, I think, was it your first 36 games you won?
Yes, that's correct.
Right? Yeah. So realistically, and I know this is a really boring question that everybody will ask you, how far up the pyramid do you think you can go?
It's a great question. It's a question, you're right, we do get asked a lot. And again, you've got the, you know, the sensible hat will just say you would take it one game at a time, all that sort of stuff. But genuinely, we have ambitions, Kevin, to go as high as we possibly can. The ultimate dream is for Jersey to have a professional football club, just like we've got a professional rugby club. Mm. So for us, I think the lowest professional club in the system is in step three. There's a handful in step two, and obviously the majority in step one are professional. So somewhere between step one and two, we could maybe fulfill those dreams of being a professional club. That doesn't mean that we're going to get there. The league is very, very competitive. And, you know, that would. So to answer your question, the ultimate goal is to become a professional football club.
It's been brilliant to talk to you. And one of the joys of this pod is that we've been able to follow stories as they unfold. And yours is one of the rare good news stories that we've covered. And I hope we carry on covering that. And we wish you nothing but goodwill for your future. You've got a cool name. You've got a really cool kit as well. But I meant to mention that. Tell listeners about your cool kit, because that's merchandising-wise, that's something you should be really pushing, because it's a great kit.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. The kits, again, I think you were talking about kits on Monday night. All of our kits are actually bespoke. So the home kit was designed by our kit partners, our technical partners, and then we, as a board, chose our favourites. And it wasn't my choice, because it resembles a little bit of 80s Liverpool home kit, or even a bit of a Nottingham Forest kit as well. So my choice wasn't chosen, so it was nothing to do with me, that one. But, you know, it's a great kit, and it was great seeing it in front of our home fans on Saturday. Our away kit, again, what we do, part of our commercial terms, is our main sponsor gets to brand the away kit in their corporate colours. Our new sponsor, Shuffle Capital, are black and white. So they basically had the choice. And again, Kappa decided, these are the different designs. And we went with sort of a black and white half. Although that was a little bit troublesome down at Beckenham the other week when the referee turned up in all black. And if we stand side on, we're all black. So that was a bit of a difficult one. And then our third kit obviously can't be red or black or white. So, and it's worked out fantastic that our gold sponsor, Butterfield Bank, are actually branded in blue. So therefore they got to have the blue corporate colours for their third kit. And what they did was really nice touch was they used the community to actually vote for one of four kits. And this one's sort of blue with a bit of salmon, and it looks a really nice kit, actually. So, the kits are really popular. We sell them all online and at the games when it's obviously possible to do so. So if any listeners out there want an alternative shirt, I must warn you, buy a size up, because they do come up a bit extra tight, hugging that Italian manufacturer in them.
Trust me, Ian, most of our listeners know to buy a size up on everything they buy. I've got one last question for you, Ian, and I think I can guess the answer to this already. Are you having fun?
Look, it's immense fun. However, over the summer, we had a tremendous games programme. We had FC United of Manchester, you know, a fan-owned club, coming to Jersey. We had Cray Wanderers down in Kent, again, an ambitious club down there. Hashtag United, again, really popular in the non-league scene. Kettering Town, who have got great history. And all of that got wiped away from us. Yeah. So when you've planned a tournament such as we planned, sold over 1,000 tickets for the tournament, organised for TV coverage to do global streaming of the event, and then that gets taken away from you, that's when it doesn't become fun. But we hope the worst is over. The vaccination process is improving all the time, and hopefully, the fun and the smiles will be here all the time.
Brilliant. It's been lovely to talk to you, Ian. Thank you so much.
Thanks, gents. All the best.
I'm slightly concerned, Kieran. It turns out it wasn't even a real sheriff that told me my hedge was overhanging. Some bloke just obviously said to his wife, "Oh, there's some English people in the street." That's not how they talk, obviously. And his wife's going, "Oh, for God's sake, Peter, not doing the fake sheriff act again, are you?" But I thought that was a really interesting interview, Kieran, and it was really good to get such a detailed personal account of how COVID has affected a club playing at that level. But Ian was too nice to say this on air, but the Jersey Bulls are doing this thing without any help whatsoever from the Jersey Tourist Board, which seems to be an incredible own goal by the Jersey Tourist Board, and just also highlights what a fantastic job this club have done to establish themselves already without any real financial help other than from sponsors towards their goal.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. I mean, Jersey does have a certain genteel reputation, and perhaps the people on the Tourist Board feel that, you know, that their perception of football it perhaps goes back to the 70s and 80s, and that we are scallywags and ruffians. Mm. But it's not. You know, football is global, and I really think that they should reconsider, because it's a chance to get Jersey on the map. The very fact that we're having this discussion, you know, this show is going to be listened to by, you know, we've got tens of thousands of listeners, and people are going, well, yeah, that is an alternative. And also, I had a chat with Ian, you know, after the interview took place, and I said, yeah, and how are things between you and Guernsey? And he says, well, if you think Brighton and Palace don't like each other, Vicar's Tea Party by all accounts.
Do you know what? I wish I'd asked that question now, but it was the first question that came into my head when I sat down to write the question. But I thought, no, that's too obvious. Everybody's going to ask him that. How are things between you and Guernsey? Well, poor old Sark and all the other ones look on in the background, saying, I wish we could have cars. But I wish I'd asked that question now. But I think also we mentioned this in the interview, the fact that, and there are so many clubs run on a similar basis, that the fact that these clubs are run by volunteers needs to be our government. You know, everybody needs to know that so many clubs are being run by volunteers, that so many clubs are struggling on a shoestring to get through life without any particular help from local authorities, governments. And it's astonishing. And it like you say, it does your heart proud to think that all this is done on a voluntary basis and done so professionally as well.
Yeah, yeah. And as you were talking about the kits, I went onto the website and I like one of the kits so much I've already ordered one. Yeah, and they are absolute crackers.
I'm pleased you said that, because I had a £5 bet with Ali. I said, I guarantee, because she just said to me, don't you dare, you've got enough football kits. I haven't got a jersey one. I knew you'd. I knew there'd be a picture of you in social media wearing another team's shirt. Thank you to everybody who listens. As Kieran mentioned, there are tens of thousands of you all over the world. If you would like to make a small monthly contribution to our always free to air pod, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have any questions for our questions pod on Monday, please email questions@priceoffootball.com, and I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, once again, folks, thanks very much for the feedback. Thanks for putting me to rights when I get it wrong. And apologies to the whole of Exeter, the city and the town, because I know I'm going to get some grief for that. If you do like the show, if you could go to that big purple icon for Apple Podcasts and give us 5 stars, doesn't matter what you write. And in fact, clearly a lot of you have taken that on board. Comments like amortize this or utter rubbish, 5 stars. Well, that's fine. What you write is fine. It's the 5 stars that help us in the charts. The fact that Ian immediately got in contact with us, and Ian, by all accounts, in fact, I thought Ian seemed to know more about the show than we do.
Yes, he did.
Which was very worrying. Yeah. It just adds to our credibility for when producer guy is trying to get in contact and book people. They look at the charts, and the 5-star reviews help us in the charts. So and remember, the show's always free, and we are completely committed to that for as long as myself and Kevin are connected to it. You know, clearly Swiss Ramble and Michael McIntyre might have other ideas, but that's for another day.
And thank you for telling me how to start a fight in an accountant's pub just by going, amortize this. it's the best threat I've ever heard. So bye everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. This is what we've got planned for you across the Athletic Podcast Network this season. The Ornstein and Chapman podcast has been rebranded as the Athletic Football Podcast. We'll release 4 episodes across the week as our journalists bring you the very best insights into the biggest stories in football and the business of sport. Michael Cox will continue to bring you the smartest analysis of all the big games in the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. Adam Hurry will now host 2 episodes of the Football Clichés podcast every single week with his usual take on the game. There's a brand new Athletic FPL podcast with our fantasy football expert, the FPL General, giving you all the advice you need to stay ahead of your mates and top of the FPL rankings. And the Athletic Podcast Network is also home now to a host of club-specific shows, some of which are going to be releasing multiple episodes every week. And we're now your destination, don't forget, for the Totally Football Show with James Richardson and the Totally Football League Show. And that is it. We can't fit any more in. All you've got to do is search for The Athletic in your podcast provider of choice, or go to our podcast section on The Athletic app. Not surprisingly, with all of the stuff that I've just mentioned, The Athletic is now the world's biggest football podcast network.